Okay, thanks very much, Tom. So my name's Adam Metzler. I'm in the Applied Math Department now at University of Western Ontario. And this is joint work with my thesis supervisor, Don McLeish. He's not at Western. He's at the University of Waterloo, and he's in the statistics department there. But I guess I'm the corresponding author for this work here. And if you want to get in touch with me, there's my email address. That's not a typo. My name is Metzler, but my email is Metzlee. They refused to give me that extra R. I asked for it, but I guess with all the budget cuts recently, I didn't get it. And so I just want to give you a very brief overview, I guess, of the multi-name first passage model that I'm going to be talking about. So we start off by modeling this admittedly abstract notion of the credit quality of an obligor. You could think of this as being related to, or you could think of it as being something like a log leverage ratio, or a solvency ratio, or an ability to pay process, but we're not going to tie it directly to any observable economic fundamentals. So we're going to model this credit quality as a continuous process, and obligors are going to default when this process hits zero for the first time. And we're going to make a clear delineation between systematic and idiosyncratic sources of risk. So we're going to say, here's systematic risk, here's idiosyncratic risk, here's how they combine to drive this credit quality process. And this delineation admits a very useful conditional independence structure. We can get asymptotic results out of it, and it also helps. It goes a long way towards actually implementing the model in a reasonable amount of time. And we found that the model calibrates quite well across both tranches and maturity simultaneously. We have CDX index tranche data from both 2006 and 2008, and we'll be spending a bit of time talking about that. Now, I realize that there are probably a lot of experts on credit risk and credit risk modeling in the room, but just in case there are not, I want to start off with a very brief review of some of the challenges we face in credit risk modeling and some of the approaches people have developed to deal with these challenges. So, the challenges, number one, the dependence structure between corporate and personal defaults is very complicated. You can get this dependence from, say, business supplier relationships. If I do 80% of my business with one customer and they go out of business, that makes it a lot more likely that I'm going to default as well. And you could also get, those are the so-called contagion effects. You could also get this dependence through, say, common dependence on a shared set of macroeconomic covariates, things like interest rate. What we're seeing right now is that a lot more people are a lot more susceptible to the state of the U.S. subprime mortgage market than we probably thought 2.5, maybe even 3 years ago. So you've got this complicated dependence structure, and an initial complication is that dynamics, things like default rates and correlation evolve dynamically through time, right? Default rates are much higher today than they were 2-3 years ago, and even default rates for Alt-A and subprime mortgages depend on when the mortgage was originated, right? If you look at the data, you can sort of see lending standards declining over the years. So you've got this complicated dependence structure. It's evolving dynamically through time, and that's compounded by the dimension of many of the problems that are faced in practice. Collateralized debt obligations could have hundreds of names in the underlying portfolio. Banks may have portfolios of thousands of mortgages or loans. And so we've got this high dimension complicates matters significantly. And so what are some of the common approaches people have taken to dealing with these challenges? Well, the copulative factor models, these are models that treat the default times as random variables whose distribution is to be modeled. And they're very attractive in that they're very easy to implement, they're very efficient to implement, especially compared to the other two frameworks. But the drawback here, I guess, is that they're very static. So with factor models, you've got these systematic risk factors that affect everybody. Their values are ostensibly determined today, and then the economic environment in which people operate is frozen in time. It doesn't evolve. There's no sort of dynamics there. Intensity models, these treat the default time as an unpredictable stopping time, or they will model the counting process. You've got a portfolio, and every time there's a default, you got a process which jumps up by one. You model directly the intensity of that counting process using intensity models. And what these can do is, you can do things like every time there's a default in the portfolio, the intensity or the local default rate of the next person to default jumps way up and then decays through time. intensity models have been very successful at capturing, in some cases, some of the dynamics that we observe, or some of the empirically observed dynamics, like the tendency for defaults to cluster in time. And these two approaches, the copula and intensity models, tend to treat defaults as processes or random variables whose distribution needs to be modeled. And structural models, which were actually the original models, the first sort of efforts at dealing with credit risk and how much should you be willing to pay for a risky bond, structural models, by contrast, try and explain why a corporation defaults. They try and relate the default event to economic fundamentals such as the value of a firm's asset and its capital structure. I think a lot of people find structural models to be intuitively the most appealing or conceptually the most appealing models. Unfortunately, they typically deal with first passage times and they can be very, very difficult to work with numerically, especially in very high dimensions. So the Black-Scholes model, this is the sort of seminal credit risk model. This is the prototypical example of a structural model. Models the value of a firm's assets as a geometric Brownian motion. So you want to interpret what this asset value is. If I cease operations today, liquidated all my assets, sold absolutely everything I had of value, F of T would represent the amount of money I bring in. It's how much all my assets are worth today. We've got this default threshold. It's a deterministic function of time. In the original paper, this represented a covenant for poor performance. So if the asset value fell below this threshold, the bondholders had the right to force the firm into bankruptcy, force it to liquidate, and default occurs at the first passage time of the asset value to the default threshold. And there are some, I'm not going to talk too much about this univariate model, but how could we turn this into a multivariate model if we wanted? How could we sort of incorporate dependence between different obligers? Well, the multivariate version is simply correlate the driving Brownian motion. So we're going to stick with the assumption of firm values being geometric Brownian motion, but we're going to correlate the Brownian motions that are driving firm values. Default thresholds are going to look very much the same, and we defaulted the first passage time of the asset value to the default threshold. And again, this is very appealing, I think, on intuitive grounds. It gives us sort of a concrete description of why a company might default, but there are some well-known issues with the model. So number one is the implementation. The relevant mathematical structure we're dealing with here is first passage times of correlated Brownian motion. And this is still very much an unsolved problem. And so the approach taken in most of the literature I've seen is to take your time horizon under consideration and discretize it and treat the bridged processes as if they were independent over each small time slice. And that's reasonable as a first approximation. But to get accurate results, you need that time slice to be quite, quite small. So it's very, very time-consuming to use this sort of naive Monte Carlo approach. There are large deviation techniques that you can use to sort of correct the bias that you get by treating the bridge process as independent. And there are also perturbation approximations that you can use up to about five dimensions that seem to work quite well for approximating, say, the distribution of the first obliger to default. So that's on the implementation side. Perhaps more damaging for the model is it provides a very poor fit to market data. And in fact, a lot of authors have found that this model produces results or prices that are very similar to the Gaussian copula, which we know doesn't work very well, at least across tranches and maturity simultaneously. And so a few authors have looked at pricing credit derivatives with this multivariate Black-Scholes model. John Hall and co-authors looked at pricing synthetic CDO tranches and found that the prices were very similar to what you would get with a Gaussian copula. Overbeck and Schmidt looked at basket default swaps and came to much the same conclusion, that the prices you get out of this multivariate Black-Scholes model are very similar to the Gaussian copula. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, actually, that seems to support the fact that the copula of the first passage times for correlated Brownian motion, in fact, is definitely not Gaussian, but it probably looks quite a bit. There's a lot of evidence that said they're probably pretty close. Okay, so those are some of the problems with Black-Scholes. And I want to take a closer look. We wanted to look at this and say, well, what's sort of the model fatal flaw here? So the relevant structure, firms are going to default in the first passage time of this credit quality process to zero. And here we're defining credit quality as the log ratio of the asset value to the default threshold, just tells us how far away we are from actually defaulting, and it's a linear Brownian motion, correlated linear Brownian motion. And these constant parameters here, mu and sigma, they represent the trend and the volatility in credit quality. And where is the dependence built in? Where is the systematic risk in the model? Well, the systematic risk is really appearing. The only dependence is through these correlated Brownian motion. So the systematic risk is appearing under the guise of this correlated noise about that trend. And if you think about it, things like average returns, stock market returns, volatilities, correlations, these things tend to be at least in part driven by the market. And so we thought perhaps the model's fatal flaw here was where systematic risk was. Okay, we thought systematic risk should probably be in things like trend and volatility. And so what we're doing, or how we're going to build our model and how it's going to differ from Black-Hawk's, is that we're going to take systematic risk out of those driving Brownian motion, out of that correlated noise about this trend, and we're going to place it into trend and volatility itself. And this is exactly how we're going to do it. We're going to model the dynamics of credit quality as follows. So we've got these two processes driving the incremental mean and variance of credit quality. They're potentially correlated, and we're gonna assume they're unobserved, at least to players in the market. Mu and sigma, these are now just deterministic functions that sort of tell us, or they reflect how sensitive an individual obliger is to these systematic processes. WI, that's a Brownian motion independent of everything. This is where we're building in firm-specific risk. This is the idiosyncratic risk, and we're gonna say that an obliger defaults at the first passage time in this credit quality process to zero. And we're gonna think, I guess, about these systematic processes, these M and Vs, as being representative maybe of the economic environment in which people operate, but we're not gonna tie them to any specific macroeconomic covariance. We're gonna treat them as sort of latent, unobserved processes that represent the general state of the economy. And so heuristic intuition, and this is heuristic, it's a little hand waving. If we look at the incremental changes in credit quality, so what happens, you know, over a day? How does that change? The way we've set things up, if H is small, the incremental change in credit quality is approximately normal, with a mean governed by M and a variance governed by V. And so you can think of these systematic factors as sort of setting the tone for a day's operation. And if you look at the incremental credit qualities, again, for small h, for two distinct obligers, those credit qualities are approximately independent. Once we've conditioned on M and V and look at a very small time horizon, the only real noise is coming from those driving Brownian motion, which we assumed independent. And so once that tone has been set, different obligers are going to operate independently. And you can sort of think of this, I like to think about it, as something like a continuous time analog of factor models, right? In that case, you've got this finite set of systematic risk factors. Their values are ostensibly determined today, and there's no time evolution. And so what we're doing here is we're saying, yes, we have these systematic factors, these risk processes, and they govern the economic environment, but they're allowed to change through time. So it's sort of a very natural way, I think, of bringing time dynamics into the conceptual framework for factor models. And some further general properties here. In general, credit qualities are not going to be Markovian. Credit qualities are going to be continuous the way we've built it up. Okay, the systematic factors, those could have jumps. They could have as many jumps as you like. But credit qualities are always going to be continuous. And to be perfectly honest, when we started looking at this model and taking it to the data, we thought, well, continuous first passage times of continuous processes, we're probably not going to be able to get those senior tranches right. We're probably not going to be able to get a lot enough mass in that sort of large portfolio loss region, but we're going to see that we can. And perhaps the most important property from an implementation perspective is that credit qualities are conditionally independent. So if we freeze or we fix the paths of those systematic factors, we get independent diffusions, we get actually independent Gauss-Markov processes, and this conditional independence structure is going to be critical when it comes time to actually calibrate the model to data. So before we get there, we're going to define this default process. It's simply going to keep track of how many people in my portfolio, how many obligers, what's the proportion of my portfolio that's defaulted up to time t. And in applications, n is typically very, very large. So it's natural to ask what happens, are there large n approximations we can use for this default process. And so when it exists, we're going to call this limit the asymptotic proportion of defaults, and we're going to see it admits, and that if you know anything about this Vasicek model, asymptotic approximations are fairly typical, and they can offer some of the advantages. They can offer a lot of dimension reduction. You can sort of strip out, or we're going to see that this using this asymptotic approximation, you can sort of strip out all the firm-specific risk and focus exclusively on the effect of the systematic factors. And also, what I like about this the approximation we're going to use is that we get a lot of insights. We can focus exclusively on the effect of those systematic factors. Get a lot of insights and intuition into the sort of nature of portfolio losses in the model. And so the large portfolio approximation with probability 1, the difference between the actual proportion of defaults and their conditional expectation based on the information provided by those market factors tends to 0. So script H here is the filtration generated by these market factors. DN is the actual proportion of defaults. And this conditional expectation here is just our best guess, right? It's our best guess at how many people are going to default based only on the systematic risk factors. And what we see is that you can essentially predict, if your portfolio is large enough, you can predict the proportion of defaults in that large portfolio using only that systematic information. You don't need to know anything at all about the idiosyncratic components. One way you might like to think about this is that in a large portfolio, all risk is systematic. And another consequence here, we've got these, we've got the limit of the difference of two sequences. And so as long as one of these limits exists, so the other one's going to exist as well, and they're going to have the same limit. And so whenever the limit, whenever D of T is well defined, whenever the limit of this default proportion is well defined, it's going to be equal to the limit of these conditional expectations. Now each of those conditional expectations is HT measurable, and that means that their limit also has to be HT measurable. So whenever it's defined, this asymptotic proportion of defaults is going to be measurable with respect to the filtration generated by the systematic factors. And in other words, when you condition on a filtration in general generated by processes, you obtain a path functional of those processes. Did you have a question? I said, okay. Okay. So we can explicitly look at what this path functional is in a few standard cases. So the case of a homogeneous portfolio, all obligers are influenced by the systematic factors in the same way. They've got exactly the same default characteristics. They respond to this economic environment in exactly the same way. The asymptotic proportion of defaults is simply equal to the conditional default probability of an arbitrary firm. And this looks probably familiar if you know anything about the Vasicek model. Based on a Merton type model, the asymptotic approximation that you can derive there. Another situation would be group portfolio. So I've got K homogeneous groups. We might think of them as industry sectors or something like that. And firms or obligers within each group are homogeneous. PK will denote the conditional default probability for an arbitrary obliger in that particular group. That should be a small k, not a capital K. And WK, that's just going to represent the proportion of defaults or the proportion of obligers in my portfolio that are from this group little k. And again, those are both typos. That should be a little k, not a capital K. And the same thing goes here. And you can write your asymptotic proportion of defaults here simply as a weighted average of the conditional default probabilities, and it's very sensible. This right here is the proportion of obligers in my portfolio that are from group K, the proportion of group K obligers who default. And WK is simply the proportion of my portfolio that's devoted to that group. And the asymptotic proportion of defaults is simply a weighted average of those conditional default probabilities. So we've looked at some of the general properties. And now it's time to have a look at the simplest possible specification of the model. It's this linear model. So a trend and volatility are random here, but we're not going to allow any time dynamics yet. They're just simply M and V are going to be random variables. We're going to start credit quality off at a constant value greater than zero. And what we've got here is we're essentially taking Brownian motion with a certain drift and a certain volatility, and we're randomizing that drift and that volatility. The asymptotic proportion of defaults, that's just the conditional default probability of an arbitrary obliger. That's just the probability that a linear Brownian motion would drift, hit zero, up to some time t. And so there's a closed form for the default rate. We can write default probabilities, default rates explicitly in terms of these systematic factors. And this is actually the reason why I'm going to spend a fair bit of time about talking about this simplest case, is that it provides, because we can write out the default rate explicitly and really see exactly, we can draw pictures and see exactly what the effect of these factors are, it's going to provide us with a lot of insights, or at least provided me with a lot of insights into what's going on when we start introducing time dynamics into these factors. And so we're going to spend a fair bit of time talking about this simple linear model because it's going to pay dividends when we try and interpret the more general dynamic model. Yes?
I have a question about those. You're saying they're not dynamics, not dynamic objects, just random variables. Could you please, I'm not sure I understand how we specify it in the context of this information structure.
So I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. Are you asking about the sort of measure, like, are these observed variables?
When do you observe them?
Oh, so I guess they're ostensibly determined today, but we're not actually going to observe them. We just know sort of what their distribution is. So we're looking at this from, say, a very statistical perspective, if that helps.
But if you don't observe them, how do you know whether the fault happens or not? Because you specify the fault with your variable X.
Right. So I might not actually observe X. I might only observe the default time. So I just might know as soon as this hits zero, and that's it. And I would have no information between when it started and when it hit zero. That's one way to specify an information structure. Is that does that answer your question at all? It's sort of, I mean, you think of like the Gaussian factor model, right? The very popular Gaussian copy model. You've got these systematic risk factors, and ostensibly they're determined today and determine when default is going to happen. Is that?
Even Gaussian copula model?
Yeah, I was just sort of...
You just mapped the distribution of default times into whatever factors you want.
But I mean, the interpretation of those factors, I mean, there's some... Well, if you observed X, you would be able to determine whether or not default happened. If you could observe credit quality, you might not know exactly what the drift is in the process. You might not know exactly what the volatility is. But if you observe at least the process, that would provide you some information on the realized values of these factors. But well, so what we're going to be doing, actually, we don't really talk about, we haven't got into the sort of flow of information, what investors would actually observe. We're going to be using this model to price credit derivatives today. And so what we're going to say, we're going to know the initial value of credit quality, and we're going to know the distribution of those two factors, and we're going to use that to price tranches of CDOs. Okay? And so one way you might want to think about it is sort of Bayesian, right? We think that the credit qualities are Brownian motion with drift, but there's a little uncertainty maybe what the actual drift and volatility is. I don't know if that helps, but that's yes.
So do you basically take the distributions of M and B and then give the entire probability?
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to calibrate the parameters of their distribution. So is that, I mean, we're sort of running. Is it okay? Can we chat about this maybe after and we can continue? Okay, and so we've got to, we know exactly what the effect of these factors is on the default rate, and that's going to provide us with a lot of information or insights. So in calibrating the model, what we're going to assume is that the factors here have a Gaussian copula, and we're going to say that that M and log V have a Laplace distribution. I'm not sure if you know anything about the Laplace distribution, but it's heavy-tailed, it's asymmetric, it's infinitely divisible. It's got all sorts of really interesting properties, and that's what we're going to use to model the distribution of these two factors. And we looked at several different possibilities for the distributions, and we found that the Laplace was the most successful. We found the number one heavy tails were pretty important for getting the most senior tranches correct, but at least as important as heavy tails were asymmetries, and this was the most successful distribution that we used. And we're going to assume sort of the pricing assumptions, constant interest rates and recovery rates. We're going to minimize the mean relative error in the mean relative pricing error. We're going to take the difference between market and model, divide it by market, and average those, their absolute values. And the surface, our objective function here, is highly irregular. Certain parameters are very, very influential in certain regions, and very, very influential, uninfluential in other reasons, in other regions. And we use the stochastic optimization algorithm known as simulated annealing, which is designed precisely to avoid or to escape from local minima. So the Greeting-Elder-Mead didn't work very well, or doesn't work very well with this problem. And we use the stochastic search algorithm, simulated annealing. The downside is that it requires significantly more function evaluations, and it can take a long time to find good parameters. But we're really interested at the present time in seeing if the framework works and can describe real data. We're going to use the large portfolio approximation. We're going to use Monte Carlo to price the tranches. And we are not going to include default swap spreads in the calibration. We've got the data, at least for 2006. We have the spreads. We're not actually going to include them in the calibration. We want to see if we can reproduce the multi-name instruments as faithfully as possible, and then check what that implies and see if that actually matches up reasonably well with the actual default swap spreads. And so here are some of the results. And so we've got 8 parameters in the model, and we are calibrating to 16 pieces of data. And it's a little bit overwhelming here. There's a lot, there are a lot of numbers up here, so I'll give you a moment to digest some of this. So it's not perfect. We've got a few serious errors. We missed the 5-year super senior tranche quite badly. We missed the seven-year mezzanine pretty badly. But other than that, we did quite well. 8 parameters, 16 pieces of data. We're very, very happy with these results. We get a reasonably uniform fit across both the tranches and maturities. And this is the data. We got it from a working paper or preprint from these authors. And so we also looked at what the model predicted. Using these calibrated parameters, calibrated to the index tranches, we looked at what the implied default swap spreads would be. And these also matched up quite closely. These, I can't remember if this was the average default swap for the names in the portfolio or the actual spread on the CDX. But either way, these matched up quite well, and we were very happy with that as well. The calibrating to the multi-name instruments, you still get very reasonable predictions for the single name as well.
So the 8 parameters are
yes.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
And
yes. So we got 3 parameters in each marginal distribution. We got a correlation parameter in the copula and the initial value of credit quality. Okay, so we had a look. I haven't actually showed you the parameters. We had a look, and we were particularly pleased with the fact that we could get those super senior tranches priced quite reasonably. And some interesting, and at first I thought these were counterintuitive observations, the correlation between the two factors exceeds 80%. This isn't exactly the correlation between the two factors, but the correlation parameter in the Gaussian copula exceeds 80% in both cases, in both 2006 and 2008. And we were expecting to find correlation, but if you were thinking about this as maybe a model for stock price, we normally think of when times are good and drift is large and returns are large, volatility is low, and the opposite, when times are bad like they are today, volatility is high. The fact that this correlation was actually positive was a little bit puzzling at first. And one of the consequences, I guess, of this positive correlation is that large portfolio losses or scenarios where the most senior tranches are impaired are characterized by very negative values of M, and that makes sense. When M is very negative, obligors are drifting towards, they're being driven towards that default barrier quite rapidly. What was surprising is that we found volatility was extremely low, or this V factor was very, very low during the same periods. And so we have this phenomenon that we would call maybe low volatility market crashes, The most severe portfolio losses are characterized by very, very small values of V. And we thought that was a little surprising at first, but it's got actually a very, very simple explanation. We take our credit quality, let's condition on the realized values of these factors. I've just got a Brownian motion, linear Brownian motion with drift. And if I let V go towards zero, I get basically a deterministic linear process. There's no more firm specific component here. There's no more idiosyncratic component when V is very, very small. And what I get is something that behaves very much like a deterministic linear process. And if that process is drifting towards the barrier, if that straight line has a negative slope, you're going to default with certainty at this critical time. And it's fairly straightforward to show that this function H, now what this function H represents, this is the first passage distribution for a Brownian motion beginning here with a drift of M and a standard deviation of V, or a variance of V actually. This is the distribution function for the first passage time of this process to zero. And as V gets closer and closer to zero, as V goes to zero, this function, which actually describes the trajectory of portfolio losses, converges to a degenerate distribution function, which assigns all of its mass to this critical point. And so what you see, or what do portfolio losses look like during one of these crashes, here's an example. It looks, so this is getting closer and closer it resembles in some sense a degenerate distribution function. And so these are typical values for the factors in cases where the super senior tranche experiences losses. That's the value of M, that's the value of V, that's the initial value of credit quality. And that critical time where everybody's supposed to default very close to is about 4.8. And so this is how this continuous model generates severe portfolio losses. Through these things that are sort of very similar or very close to degenerate CDFs. And it's really sort of now or never. If the senior tranche, or even if the senior tranche is impaired, the trajectory of portfolio losses will in almost every single case look exactly like this. And so this is how it's a sort of all or nothing phenomenon. Either everybody defaults or nobody does, and that's kind of the way that the super senior tranche is going to experience losses. And so we thought maybe this sort of led us to reinterpret what these systematic factors are. We want to look at the roles of these two factors on credit qualities. Well, number one, a Brownian motion is dominated by its drift, okay? Credit quality is asymptotic to this linear portion, to its linear portion as T gets very, very large. And so we can think of M as sort of the dominant long-term force here. We've got two terms. We've got a linear term and a Brownian term. The fluctuations, this can and will fluctuate, but it won't fluctuate at nearly a linear rate in time, and M is really sort of the dominant long-term force. And this factor V, which we were originally sort of thinking of and talking about as a volatility factor, and when we started working with Wall model, we thought it would probably be related to something like stock volatility. It appears, at least what the data is trying to tell us, and the model is trying to tell us, is that the role of V here is to really modulate the influence of that idiosyncratic component, or the firm-specific risk. And that firm-specific component, when times are bad and M is small, the correlation means the V is also going to be small, and so what we get, or the role of V, the primary role, is to sort of downgrade the influence of firm-specific risk in severe market downturns. And so we look at the calibrated densities, comparing both 2006 to 2008. So 2008 is the red line and 2006 is the black line. And as expected, the density of M has sort of shifted over. Bad times are a lot more likely now. There's a lot more risk in the system, if you will, and it's become a lot more asymmetric. But there's not a fundamental change here between these two densities. The real change comes from what happens with V. So these are the calibrated densities between both 2000 and 2006. These are actually the densities for log V. The densities for V are so different that if you plot them on the same plot, I mean, one doesn't even show up. They're on completely different scales. And all of the mass for V has been shifted way, way over towards regions where V is very, very small, or in other words, most of the mass has been shifted over to that region where idiosyncratic or firm-specific risk is downgraded. Doesn't really matter. And so one way of sort of looking at this, or what I would interpret from these calibrated parameters, or what the model is sort of telling us, is that idiosyncratic risk has, in a sense, been sort of priced out of the market. The primary difference between the 2006 and 2008 data is seen with these densities, and we see that, in fact, V is almost always negligible in 2008. Idiosyncratic, or the firm-specific component, has been sort of forced out of credit qualities. And so the model is not perfect. We like the model. It calibrates the data. We can give some sensible interpretation to the calibrated parameters, but it's not perfect, right? No model is perfect, but some are useful. The major flaw here is that there are no time dynamics in those systematic factors, right? The economic environment. M and V are stochastic, but they don't evolve through time. The environment in which obligors operate is really frozen in time. And what that means is that there's really no recovering from a recession here in this model, and that leads to those situations where 100% of the portfolio defaults in a very short time. And there's no cyclicality in the default rate. So if times are bad, they stay bad forever. If times are good, they stay good forever. And there's no sort of switching between the two different, extreme states. And another problem is what I would call the predictability of the default rate. Now, I'm not talking about prediction, accessible, inaccessible, stopping times and things like that. I'm talking about something else, but as we are running low on time, I think I'm just going to skip over that. So the issue, or the major issue I have with the linear model, is that there are no time dynamics in these systematic factors. And so the next step to sort of improving the model is to add time dynamics. So now we're going to allow M and V to be processes, for everything to be well defined. They've got to have integrable sample paths. And again, we're going to begin credit quality at some constant value greater than zero. And so the incremental, we've now randomized and allowed some time and allowed time dependence in the incremental changes in these credit qualities. We're permitting this environment to evolve through time. And the most difficult part, at least from an implementation or computational standpoint, is what happens to conditional default probabilities when we allow these factors to vary through time. And so I'm going to run through this. Let's condition on the realized paths of these factors. This is what my credit quality is. And this martingale term here, this Brownian integral, at least has the same law as the time change Brownian motion. So we can rewrite credit qualities in terms of a time change Brownian motion with arbitrary drift, okay, nonlinear drift. And we default at the first time this process hits zero. What we're really dealing with here is default times, or first passage times, for time change Brownian motion to nonlinear barriers. All right, and they're well established. Things get a little more difficult. Default probabilities or conditional default probabilities are no longer available in closed form, but there are all sorts of computational techniques that we can use to approximate them. We know that the first passage distribution will satisfy a non-singular Voltaire equation, and we can also use piecewise linear approximations. We could approximate the time change in the barrier with piecewise linear functions, and we show it's relatively easy to show that approximation converges to the true value as you increase the number of nodes. I'm going to skip over this slide right here and get into an example. So what we're going to do is we're going to model M and V as stationary mean reverting diffusion processes. They're not exactly Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes. M is going to be a mean reverting, it's going to be a mean reverting diffusion with this diffusion coefficient or function. V is also going to be mean reverting. It's going to have a different diffusion coefficient. Z1, Z2 are correlated Brownian motion. So we're building the dependence between these two factors through these driving correlated Brownian motion. And we had a lot of success with this Laplace and log of Laplace distribution with the linear model, and we looked around to see if it was possible to find a mean reverting diffusion and choose the diffusion or the volatility function in such a way that the resulting process had the Laplace distribution as its stationary distribution, and that's actually possible. There's a wonderful paper. I don't have the reference here, but I could give it to you at the end of the talk, by Bibby and co-authors, where they show if you want to construct a mean reverting diffusion process that looks like this, and you want it to have a target pre-specified stationary distribution, they show exactly how to choose your diffusion function to do so. And so here we've got the calibration results for the diffusion model for the 2008 data. And this the whole reason I got this out of a preprint on default risk, and the whole reason for that paper was that the Gaussian copula model, or the industry standard sort of model, was simply not able to generate enough mass in that extreme large portfolio loss region to be consistent with these very, very large tranche spreads for the senior tranches. And we were really impressed, or we were really happy with the fact that that we could come quite close. We've got actually 10 parameters in this model and now 15 pieces of data. And the last time I gave this talk, somebody asked me what the CDS curve would look like using these implied parameters. I gather, or I'm told, that at this time, in 2008, that curve was humped. And actually, if you plot the CDS curve, so you take the implied parameters and you calculate default swap spreads, you do observe this hump shape. And I think the troubling thing for the person who asked me that question was, because we're dealing with first passage times, you're not going to be able to get this sort of hump-shaped behavior. But in fact, when you randomize that barrier and you allow it to be almost arbitrary, nonlinear, you can get almost any distribution function you want for the first passage times. And so I'm going to wrap up very, very shortly here. The dependence between M and V is built by these correlated Brownian motion. We found there's a lot of correlation between M and V here. The correlation parameter between those driving Brownian motions exceeds 98% in both cases, 2006 and 2008. And so it's almost as if these two factors are really being driven by one source. And again, large portfolio losses or the senior tranches impaired in periods where M spends a prolonged amount of time well below zero and V spends a prolonged amount of time very close to zero. And so that was sort of similar to what we had in the linear model, except now we've got these time dynamics. And unlike the linear model, the economy can recover here, and you can observe cyclical behavior with default rates, and that's exactly why we took this step and added time dynamics to these systematic factors. And so here's a plot. So these are simulated paths. Here I've simulated a path for that M, for that drift parameter, and below I've generated a path for that V parameter, the volatility or the sort of idiosyncratic weighting, that factor. And there's some correlation. When M spends a lot of time below its long run mean below zero, V is also doing the same thing. And here up top, I have plotted the associated trajectory for the default rate using that asymptotic approximation. And we do observe, number one, this sort of cyclical behavior. Okay, things were quite bad between years 2 and 4. The economy recovered for a little while, and things got very bad again at the end of 8 years. We've got this sort of cyclical or clustering of defaults. And the second problem, we didn't really get into this, is that there's sort of no... You know, since we didn't get into it, I skipped over that slide. I'm not going to say anything about it now. But this is sort of, we get those sort of features that we were missing in the linear model. And so at 7 o'clock, I believe, Okay. Thank you very much. I've got another, actually, I think just about one or two more slides. And so I wanted to sort of see or show you exactly what these credit qualities looked like. I thought this was a very interesting picture in a market downturn. And so what I've plotted here, credit quality, it's the average path or the trend in credit quality is given by the integral of this M factor. And that's what I've plotted up here. So this is the integral of M, and we can see that M has actually got to be very, very negative here because, the derivative of this function is quite negative over this region. And so this is a period, this is one of these crash periods where M spends a prolonged amount of time below zero. And what I've plotted down here at the very bottom is the associated path of V. This isn't the integral of V, it's the actual path of V. So when M is very negative and driving credit qualities towards zero. V is hanging around zero and saying, well, firm-specific risk or idiosyncratic risk doesn't really matter now, okay? Everybody is sort of at the whim or at the mercy of the market. And what we have in the middle is a whole bunch. I think there's about 10 different credit qualities right here. And what you can see, things are going along swimmingly. Everybody's sort of moving around more or less independently. As soon as trouble hits at 5 years, everybody gets, I mean, these things look almost identical. Everybody gets herded straight towards the default barrier at a very rapid pace, and there's nothing anybody can do about it, right? This Brownian term here on this region is basically meaningless. It's got no effect. And I think I'm ready to wrap up. So some conclusions and some discussion about what we want to do with future work. Number one, I thought it was interesting, and to be perfectly honest, when we first started working on this, I didn't think that these continuous credit qualities or these models based on continuous or first passage times of continuous processes would be able to get enough mass in that large portfolio loss region. I think there's sort of a tacit assumption that you need jumps to be able to generate enough mass in that really large region, and we were very impressed. We think it's sort of an important conclusion that you don't actually need jumps to fit market data. What we would also like to do, this credit quality is sort of an abstract concept at the present time. We'd like to relate this to observable covariates. We'd like to be able to build a model where you could sort of infer something about credit quality based on things like maybe implied volatility or volatility in credit default swap spreads. Another thing we'd like to do is look at the dynamics of credit spreads, default swap spreads, tranche spreads. We'd like to look at the impact of various specifications for the information flow available to investors. Do we observe only defaults? Do we observe credit quality as well? And those are all very interesting problems that we're just sort of starting to scratch the surface on now. And the last thing, this diffusion-based model, what we're really interested in those are those unlikely sort of large portfolio loss regions. And if you're implementing the model with Monte Carlo and you're interested in seeing what happens in the worst-case scenario, important sampling is a very natural candidate, but we're dealing here with important sampling for diffusion processes. And that's a very, very underdeveloped topic. And we've started working a little bit on important sampling for Brownian motion and using as a technique for selecting an importance measure. When we talk about important sampling for diffusion processes, we're really talking about measures on path space. And we've played around with choosing entropy or minimizing relative entropy as a technique for selecting effective importance distributions. And in a few simple cases, it's worked out really, really well. And that's, I'm sorry, I ran a little bit over time. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for your time. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.